Good morning. We are happy to be here again. God has kind of opened up the doors. We left Grand Junction. You know, weather's been weird down here, and it's been weird in Grand Junction, too. And we had 2 days where the whole of Grand Junction was an ice rink, and and so we kind of thought we might get that while we headed down here, but God has really opened it up. So, you know, we pray for snow too, but we always pray for snow on the sides of the road where we're going. And, you know, God has really been blessed us. And so, anyway, we are so happy to be here again. There are some people that don't know who we are. My name is Lanny Johnson, my wife Marilyn Johnson back there. We do work with Alpha Omega Institute. We are a smaller creation organization out of Grand Junction, Colorado. And this month, Marilyn and I are now going into our 24th year working with Alpha Omega. Our ministry right from the very beginning with Alpha Omega has been for children. Later it turned from children into families. And that's how we really present. We kind of everybody out here is kids to us. Anybody younger than me is a kid. But anyway, I really want to be some sharing. We were going to have some kids here, so I already went on ahead. I was going to do this talk I'm doing right now. But I really didn't want to change it because it is good for everybody. Because what we're going to be looking at is some very special animals, some that are a little different than I normally teach about. So we're going to look at that. Again, we're going to be talking about the two different ideas of where we came from, where that idea over on the right is evolution, which teaches basically we're here by chance and accident, one mistake on top of another. And it teaches there is no God. It would just happen by mistake. And if you recall, I used to believe that very strongly. I went to college, became a geologist, and I was taught evolution as truth, as fact. And because of what I was taught, I decided I could no longer believe in the Word of God. Because the Word of God tells us that God made everything out there, but evolution says, no, it all happened by chance and accident. So I took a look at that Bible that I had begun learning when I was young, decided I could no longer believe the Word of God. So I took the Word of God, the Bible, and threw it away. And when I did that, I quit believing in God. And I quit believing in God for over 20-some years. But I was challenged and really went back and started looking at the evidence. And I really was convinced that there is no evidence for evolution out there. Nothing scientific that backs it up. There's a lot in the statements that says it happened, but where's the evidence? Where's the proof? I could not find it, and I still cannot find it today. What I was seeing was lots of evidence that looked like God, or somebody smart, I should say, had made everything out there, and I believe that somebody is God. So I believe in creation 100% today. Well, so we're going to look in this idea. Now, some of this, some of you are going to see a little bit familiar at the beginning, but once I get the animals, these are all new. I've never taught these here before, so just bear with me. When we look at things like this, I love to show this one to kids. And I ask kids, what are these? And once in a while, they'll finally say they're rocks and everything, but most of the time, they'll recognize that these are what? Arrowheads. And then the question is, how do you know they're arrowheads? Now, some of you might have found arrowheads. Some of you might have studied arrowheads. Some of you actually made arrowheads. But I can show these to small children who do not have a clue what they are. They don't know what the name of them, but they'll recognize something right away about arrowheads. Arrowheads have a different shape than other rocks. Whenever we have shape, we have a word we call design. And whenever we have design, we always, 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 can everybody say always with me? Always have a designer. In other words, somebody that's smart that made that design. For example, arrowheads. Who made arrowheads? People made arrowheads. We have cultures all over the world that have made arrowheads. And how did they make them? Well, they use tools. Most of the time, they'll take one type of rock and chip it on another rock. And so they use rock. Sometimes they use things like antlers, things like that. So they use tools, but they use something even more important than tools. What do they use? This right in here. They use your brains. I like to say it took smarts to make these arrowheads. They did not happen by chance or by accident. It took somebody smart to actually make them. Now, how many in here would believe a story like this? Up in South Dakota, there's a mountain range. And how many of you believe over millions and millions and millions of years, as evolution would teach, the one Sangreedy time fell off this mountain through wind and freezing, thawing, and things like that, and until this was made by chance and by accident? Would anybody in here believe that idea? No, of course not. And in fact, if you go up to Mount Rushmore, where this picture is taken, and ask anybody up there, hey, do you think that happened by chance and accident? They'd look at you like you're crazy. They say, of course not. That took some intelligent people to carve that wonderful design up on those mountains. But then, those same people, many of them will turn around and look you right in the eye and say, ah, but I think you happened by chance and accident. I think you're a product of evolution. Well, I really don't understand that anymore. Because when I look at the human body, when I look at us, I see all kinds of design. When we look at our heart, our lungs, our brain, our cells, the DNA in those cells, everything about us looks like it was done by design, by somebody smart out there. Right? So when I look at that there, there's a lot more design in us than up on Mount Rushmore. And I know Mount Rushmore was not done by chance and accident. It was done by design. So I realized because of the design in you, somebody smart had to make you also out there. Look at things like this. You all see these parts up in here? Now, do you think these parts here happened by chance and accident? No, they look like they're made by somebody, but somebody smart. But they don't make much sense. So here's what I always challenge kids to do. You guys can help me out if you'd like to do it. In fact, if you would help me out. Everybody pretend you have a paper bag. Hold your paper bag up here in the air for me. Now put these parts in it, close it up. Now shake it real good. Shake, 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 shake. Now dump it down on the ground. Now is this what you're going to get by chance or by accident? Now are you sure? See, evolution says it takes lots of time, lots of chances, and lots of accidents. When I believed in evolution so strongly, one of my main arguments was for evolution, well, given enough time, anything can happen. But can it really? Well, let's do it again. Get your bag back out there, put those parts in, shake it up, dump it out, shake it out, 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 dump it out. You can do that till the cows come home. But are you ever going to produce a working, functioning clock in that manner? No, what's going to happen is those parts are going to wear out, erode away. We know that it took an intelligent designer. In this case, it was what? It was a clockmaker. Now, do y'all look up there and see the clockmaker stand next to the clock? No, but you recognize there was a clockmaker. Why? Because of the evidence came to his handiwork. Even though you can't see him, you know there had to be a clockmaker. And what about God? You know, we can't see God, can we? No, God's a spirit. All right? But He has given us all kinds of things that we can look out there that know He exists. And so we're going to look into that again today. One more example of that. Could it have happened by chance and accident? Well, here we have a junkyard full of all kinds of parts. Again, we're going to try to make something by chance and accident. Look at all the parts we have. We have all kinds of metal. So we have metal, we have iron, we have steel. We have windows, we have rear windows, front windows, side windows. We have rear seats, we have bucket seats, we have lights, tires, motors, engines, all kinds of stuff. So again, we're going to try to make something by chance and by accident. Now, we cannot take this and put it in a paper bag, shake it up. So we're going to do a little bit different. We're going to bring a big force of energy right through this. We're going to bring a tornado right through the middle of this junkyard and stir it up real good. Now, after that tornado goes to the junkyard, is this what it's going to make by chance and by accident? No, that is really, truly a silly idea, isn't it? But do you know a couple of astronomers that were actually atheists, that did not believe in God? They actually sat down once and figured out what it would actually take for that very thing to happen. The mathematical odds or the probabilities of a tornado going through a junkyard to make an airplane like this. At the same time, they sat down and figured out what it would take to make a living cell, one single cell, by chance and accident through the process of evolution. And you know what they discovered? It would actually have been far easier for that tornado to go through that junkyard and make a 747 full of fuel and ready to fly than it would for that cell to ever have happened on his own. In fact, the probabilities they came up with was this right in here. They said the chance of a cell happening through the process of evolution by chance and by accident is only one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power. Now, that 10 to the 40,000th, what you have to understand, that's the number one followed by 40,000 zeros. That is a number that is so large, we really cannot even wrap our mind around it. They're saying that one chance in all those tries, that many trials and errors, there will only be one chance in that huge amount of tries to get it right. Now, it's hard to understand that. So, 10 to the 40,000, we really can't comprehend it. Now, today they're teaching this, though. They're teaching that, and this has to be an estimate because nobody really truly knows how big the universe is. But the standard today is there's electrons. Well, we have the atom. Everything's made out of atoms, electrons, protons, neutrons. Today, they're saying that we have approximately 10 to the 79th power of electrons in this universe. Now, that's not so many, is it? Well, actually, remember, that's the number one followed by 79 zeros, and I can actually show you what that looks like, right? That's that number right in here. By the way, our deficit is still only up in this top line up in here. It got really big here the last 8 years, but it's still only right up in here someplace, all right? But this is a huge number. a huge number. But understand, the chance of life happening is 10 to the 40,000. So what you have to do is take 505 more boxes full of zeros like this and put that behind the number one, and that's the chances of anything happening by chance and by accident, life happening by chance and accident. Scientists tell us today that anything larger than 10 to the 50th power is impossible to happen. We're looking at 10 to the 40,000th power. So what does that tell us? That the chances of the cell, the thing that makes up our bodies, the chance of that happen through the process of evolution is absolutely zero. Can you all say that with me? Zero. Now, by the way, this was done back in the 70s when they came up with these figures. They know a lot more about the cell today. The deeper we look into DNA, the cell and everything, the more complex it's getting. It's not getting any simpler. Dave Nutting is our director of Alpha Omega. He actually read a quote that said they've redone this figure and said it's actually closer to one chance in 10 to the 5 millionth power today. So if that is actually true, then the chances of if you could make zero any bigger, the chances just got a whole lot bigger, but it's still essentially zero out there, absolutely zero. So how did it happen? Well, when we look at Romans 1:20, it says this, "For the invisible things of him being God, from the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." What God is essentially telling us here very simply is all we have to do is look around nature, and God has left us enough examples in nature that we should know that he exists, that he is actually there. Now, by the way, I've actually been able to convince lots of people over the years that there has to be a creator by the things that God has made. So I'm going to share a few more with you here today. But then this thing is, well, who is that creator? And that's really not a bad question, because I can convince people that there is a creator. Nature will tell us that. But does nature tell us who that creator is? There's lots of gods in this world. There's a Hindu god, the Buddhist god, the New Age has all kinds of different gods. There's lots of gods in this world. But there's only one true God. And where do we find the one true God? Through his word. That's a lot of people try to separate, well, I can just run around nature and I can know who my God is. No, you can know there is a God, but to truly know that God, you need his word. And by the way, we're going to look at the authority of the Bible in the second half. Know that the word of God is true. God goes on to say this at the end of this. So they, and who's they? That's us, are without excuse. Really, there's not any excuse for anybody in the world not to understand there has to be a creator out there. All they have to do is look at the things that he has made. The heavens declare the glory of God. These animals I'm getting ready to show you declare the glory of God, I think. So we're going to look at some different animals out here. Now, if you recall, one of my favorites that I've already taught here is a bombardier beetle, woodpecker, things like that. I'm going to give you a couple others that are really some of my favorite. For example, the giraffe. The giraffe is just a really cool animal, I think. Now, the adult males, they can be up to 20 foot tall. We know they have the long legs and the long neck and everything else. By the way, that gives them a little advantage over other animals and everything out there. Right? They can actually, because of their height and everything, they can get up to where everything else is eating everything down below. They can still have nutrients and everything to the trees that other animals can't eat. And they not only do they have the long neck, by the way, they have a very long tongue. The tongue is actually about 18 inches, which is about from my elbow to my tips of my finger right up in here. How many of you ever been to Colorado Springs to the zoo there? You ever been to the zoo there? If you're ever down there, go to the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo. They have lots and lots of giraffes, and I really love how they do it, because the giraffes are down in a hole, and you're kind of up at their eye level. So they're coming up and looking you eye to eye. Now, I did something a couple of years ago. I had a couple of my grandsons with me. We were doing a vacation Bible school there, so we took them to the zoo. We were in there looking at the giraffes, and you can actually buy little biscuits. You can actually feed the giraffes. Well, most people will take the biscuit, and they'll reach out and hold it, and the giraffe will come up and take it out of their hand. I do a little bit different. My grandsons were with me, so I had to do it a little bit different. So what I do, I take the little biscuit and I put it in my mouth, and I just hold my mouth out there. That giraffe, she just come lumbering up. She got about 18 inches from my head, and all of a sudden that tongue come out there, came out and took that biscuit right out of my mouth and gave me just a little tiny kiss as it pulled it out of there, right? Their tongues are just amazing. By the way, the tongue is dry. It's not a little wet, sloppy tongue or anything like that. I tried to get my grandsons to do it, but they just couldn't handle it that way. But if you want to impress your grandkids, just try that method right in there. Also, because of their height, they're very good lookouts. Because they're up there, they can actually look down into the grass and everything to see if there's danger sneaking up and everything. Now, other animals have learned that hang around the giraffe to watch the giraffe. If the giraffe starts getting nervous, then they know that something might be out there, they need to be nervous too. So there's lots of things, advantages to it out there. But there are also some problems we're going to look at to having a very long neck. If you look at the giraffe's head up there, it is actually 8 foot above his heart. Now, the heart is very, very important because it's pumping blood. You have to have blood to your brain at all times. Now, you see a little problem there. When we look at our heart is only about this big right in here. But he has a big, big heart. Because what he has to have a strong muscle to pump lots and lots of blood uphill, which goes against gravity, so it takes a lot of power to get it uphill. Well, he has a very good design there. His heart is about 2 to 2.5 feet long, where ours is only about the size of our fist, weighs about 25 pounds, but is a very, very strong muscle. So it can pump lots of blood at high blood pressures up to that brain. So, no problem for the giraffe. But there's other problems there. What happens when he goes to the watering hole? The giraffe has a little bit of a problem because his neck is actually shorter than his legs and his upper body. So to actually get to the water, down to get the water, he actually has to do a little acrobatics. He has to spread his legs out a little bit. But here's where the big, big problem comes in. Now that heart, that strong heart, was pumping lots and lots of blood at high blood pressure uphill, which is hard to do. Now that blood, that heart is pumping lots of blood at high pressure downhill, which is now easy to do. So what should happen to that giraffe's head? How many of you have ever blown up a balloon, put too much pressure in it? What happens? Kapow. This is what happens, just like that right in there. All right? Scientific guys, physics shows us that brain, that head should just blow right up off when all that blood pressure hits it now, tremendous pressures now, which is very easy to do. But does it? No, all right? We're not left with giraffes out there without a head out there. And really, I think it's pretty cool because I really don't want to look at a giraffe like that very long. In fact, I'm going to change him back to show why doesn't that happen. Well, there's a very special mechanism along the blood vessels, the main arteries that are pumping blood up to the brain. It's very much like a muscle that's wrapped around the blood vessel. And it actually has sensors on it. These sensors are so sensitive, they can actually tell that the blood pressure is getting too high, and they will actually give a signal to those muscles, and those muscles will start squeezing down till it cuts off a large amount of that flow. Some is still getting through, but it is cutting down the main volume coming through. And so that is why, when it gets down there, it doesn't pop its head off. A safety valve on there also, these muscles take a little while to squeeze down. So behind, right in the base of the neck, is actually what they call a wonder net. The blood comes into it, and it's like a net, so it spreads out, kind of the sore spreads out a ways. So as this stuff shutting down, this wonder net will catch that little extra pressure for just a moment and spread out and capture that would blow it out. All right? And it's all by a wonderful, wonderful design. Now, here's my question. How did the giraffe ever survive? How did he ever get that first drink, reach down there, and survive the first drink he ever tried to take in his life? Boom, his head is gone. Once your head is gone, the rest of the giraffe is gone. Now, do you think this design happened by chance and accident? Or do you think that happened by design, intelligent design? I believe it was intelligent design. He has another problem, too. He's down there taking a drink, and a lion sneaks up, makes a big growl out there. What's he going to do? He's going to get up and run, because he is in danger when he's in that position right in there. So he's going to... Now, giraffes, their neck, by the way, can weigh up to 500 pounds on the adult, so they don't just raise their neck slowly. In fact, what they observed in the wild, whenever they come up out of the watering hole, they actually take that neck and they throw it up in the air. And they'll throw it high enough, they'll actually bring up the front of their body, and they snap their legs back together, and now they're ready to go. But now they have another huge problem. Now you have the blood cut off to your brain, or the volume now is very small. You throw your head up there. How many of you, when you get up too fast, what happens to you? Or you go around in circles, you get dizzy. When you get dizzy, what happens to a lot of us? Over we go. We fall over. Now, every time he throws his head up, he goes into a dead faint, laying on the ground. Do you think he's going to survive very long? No. But here's the amazing thing. Those sensors work the opposite way also. They recognize right away that it needs more blood, it needs more volume, and it has those muscles open back up so blood can flow through. And while it's getting triggered up there, the blood that was in that wonder net actually supplies the blood with the brain so he doesn't pass out there. Again, chance an accident, or does that sound like something that happened by design? Another one of my favorite animals is this guy here. This is called the Mallee fowl. He lives down in Australia. He is what they call, he's in a group of birds called megapods, which means big-footed birds, and he does have big feet. Now, this is the papa right in here. This is probably one of the most dedicated fathers in the animal kingdom, because this guy will spend almost 11 months out of the year, out of the 12 months, he'll spend 11 months out of that year working on a nest system for baby chicks. And here's what he does. With those big old feet of his, he'll actually take and scratch out a hole down into the ground. And he does it by himself. The wife doesn't help him there. Just the papa helps him, or does the work right in here. But using those feet, he'll dig a hole. And that hole sometimes can be 15 foot across, up to 15 foot high. He can move up to 3 tons of material. That's equivalent to 6 to 8 carloads of dirt and everything. All right, and he does it all on his own with his feet. Now, once he gets his hole nice and deep, now the mama comes up and checks out his work. If the mama's happy, the papa's happy. And now, once he gets a hole, now they start doing something kind of peculiar. Now they go around, and working together now, they'll start going in, getting all kinds of limbs and twigs and leaves and things like that, and filling that hole back up. That he took so much time to empty all the dirt and sand out of, now they fill it back up with vegetation. As soon as they get it nice and full, now they wait for something to happen. They wait for it to rain. As soon as it rains and this vegetation gets nice and wet, then the papa goes back to work and he will bury that mound, put dirt over all that vegetation. What begins to happen to that plant material now is buried that is wet, it begins to ferment and decay, and what it begins to do is start building off heat. It produces heat. He actually uses this as an incubator. Excuse me. In fact, his second name is an incubator bird. It's kind of like we had a wild duck visit our house, and we had a little pond there, and the duck showed up. The duck was laying eggs. The raccoons love the eggs. And they kept coming stealing them. So finally we started stealing the eggs, and we put them under a light bulb, and we incubated. We got a little baby ducklings out of that from that duck. And so same process. We're using artificial heat. That's what the bird is doing right in here. So that's its second name, called the Mallee fowl or the incubator bird. Now, this temperature has to get just to the right temperature for these eggs to actually hatch. Once it gets to the right temperature, then he will actually dig down and make a little nest thing. How does he know the temperature, though? Well, this is another amazing thing. They're not really sure how he does it, but he will actually take the temperature with his beak and his tongue. He will stick it down in the soil, and he can measure the temperature within 1 degree, of 92 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm going to do something I'd hardly ever do, but I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to suck on something while I talk to you. Right? It is named the thermometer bird. He can measure the temperature within 1 degree of 92 degrees. Now, once it gets up to 92 degrees down in that soil, now he'll dig a little nest area right in there. The mama and I'll come in and lay an egg. Then she'll go off and she'll rest for a couple of days. She needs that rest because her egg is one-third of her size. She's about the size of a large chicken, but her egg is one-third of her size. So it takes a lot out of her. So she has to go and rest. She'll actually lay anywhere from 60 to 30 eggs. Now, as soon as that first egg is laid, the papa will go back to work. He will actually cover that egg, and he'll continually monitor those eggs from here on out. He'll make sure that they stay at 92 degrees. If it's getting too hot from the heat below, he'll start scratching some of the dirt off to release some of that heat. If it gets too hot from the sun above, he'll start adding, insulate, putting dirt on it. So it's constantly taking dirt off, putting it on, taking it off, putting it on. Again, the papa does this all by himself. Now, the mom lay anywhere from 60 to 30 eggs. Now, these eggs hatch out different than ducks and other animals. Every one of these, instead of all hatching out at the same time, their incubation began right as soon as they were laid. So now these will start coming out at different times, depending on when they were laid. It takes 9 weeks for this baby chicken side to develop, 9 weeks. Once the 9 weeks come, now the first miracle is that little baby chick buried underneath all that stuff will get out of the egg. Now, it has some very special tools, a little egg, what they call an egg tooth, to get out of the shell itself. But now the biggest problem, once it gets out, the baby chick now has to dig its way out. The mom and dad don't help him. The baby chick actually digs her own way out. Now, if they go straight up, they're in pretty good shape. But if they go sideways, they've got a long ways to dig. So they get out. When they finally do get out, they're pretty exhausted. And the first thing they'll do is they'll get off that mound, and they'll go hiding underneath the bush for 24 hours. Now, the next day, only 24 hours after that baby chick hatched out and dug his way out, the little baby chick will now turn around and fly. Now, get that, will fly off in the woods. And as far as they've observed, their mothers and fathers never, ever come into contact with that baby chick. Yet that baby, when it's born, is fully feathered and knows how to fly right from the very beginning. And the mother and father did not teach them that. They get into the woods. They know that somehow they're a seed eater. They know what kind of seeds to eat. They know that somehow when they're 2 years old, it's time to find a mate. They get to mate. They start doing this. They start building nests, taking temperatures, everything. Yet the mom and dad never taught them. Now the question is, how do they know how to do that? Well, there's a word in science we call instinct. Instinct. What is instinct? Just knowing how to do something. It was actually programmed into it, almost like a computer. Now, evolution has tried to explain instinct for just time and time again, and they've really failed at it. There used to be a Lamarckian thing, said, well, the mom and dad learned this and somehow passed it along in their genetics and everything, but they've done lots of tests. One of the tests, one scientist, he began with two mice, long-tailed mice, a boy mouse and a girl mouse, had long tails. Before he let them get together and start having babies, he took out his pocket knife and whacked their tails off, so now they're short-tailed mice. Now, the baby, so they had babies, they came out, they had long tails, so they took the knife and chopped the tails off. Generation after generation after generation after generation, these mice were born. Every time, they always had long tails. Now, if evolution was true, they say, hey, that's not too cool to have your tail whacked off, so let's just take care of ourselves through chance and accident and come out with a short tail. Now, these guys can't mess with us. So let's change our own genetic material. Well, they test all kinds of different tests and find out there's no way we can change our own DNA code there. We can't do that. It's been shown that. So how did it happen? Well, evolution really can't explain it. Sometimes science can't explain everything we see out there. Sometimes we have to take things by faith. My faith is there was an intelligent designer out there, and he programmed this information into it. Science can't explain it. As much as I love science, we've never been able to explain instinct. But yet it's there. We observe it, but it looks like it was done by design. Knowledge programmed before birth. There's a little bacteria out there. Now, whenever we hear of an E. coli bacteria, we kind of panic because Ebola bacteria can be bad for you. Actually, our bodies has quite a bit of E. coli bacteria on us. But once in a while, it gets a little rampant, gets a little too much. It can be very dangerous for us. This is a picture. This is an actual photograph of an E. coli bacteria down in the lower right-hand corner, and this was a drawing of it right here. You notice this, it's just a single-cell bacteria, very, very small, very, very tiny. That little thing that comes off is actually, this is what we call the flagellum right in here. If this little guy right here will actually take and spin, this is how he moves around, he or she, I don't know if they actually have genders, all right, but actually they'll take that little flagellum and whip it around at very, very high speeds. And it's ran by a motor, a very, very tiny motor. In fact, if they started studying this E. coli bacteria and the mechanism inside of it, that little motor that runs all this, they determined that 8 million of them, to show how tiny it is, if you take a hair and take one of your hairs, pluck it out of your head and do a cross-section, you cut it across, 8 million will fit into the end of the hair right in there. So these are the things. We're talking about something very, 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 very microbiology. This motor, by the way, can actually whip around up to 100,000 RPM. That's 100,000 times per minute. That's pretty quick. And they say they can actually stop on a dime and reverse direction and give you change. It works that fast. It's all ran by the little motor right in here. when we take a close look at that motor, it has some parts in it that you might recognize that we find someplace else. It has a propeller. That's what we call the flagellum. It has a universal joint right in here that connects this is able to rotate. And down here has a bushing, drive shaft, stator, and rotors. What are you looking at right in there? Y'all recognize it? It's electric motor. The same principles, the same parts as electric motor we find in this little tiny one-cell thing called E. coli bacteria. Now, I ask you a question. Did that motor down there, the electric motor, did that happen by chance and accident? Did you throw a whole bunch of parts in the corner one day and somehow these parts kept kicking, bumping them? They finally came together. Woo, we got some motor all of a sudden, all right? There's no way. We look at things like motor, we recognize it took design, intelligent design. It's the same thing. We look at the E. coli. Could that have happened by chance and accident? There's too much design. There's a man, he was actually named Michael Behe. He was a very strong evolutionary scientist at one time. He came up with this a term called irreducible complexity. And I'm just going to try to simplify it. It simply means that a series or group of related functioning working parts must all work together at the same time, or the thing doesn't work. Irreducible complexity really does point to a designer, because you can have all these parts that should work together, but unless they are together at the right specific time working together, every one of these, they're not ever going to come together to make anything. It looks everything like it was everything by design. One example of that, for example, is a mousetrap. This is one he uses, and it's really a very simple idea right in here. You have a mousetrap. There's really not much to a mousetrap, is there? What we have is that we have the base right in here, made out of a piece of wood. You have a spring right in here. You have a catch to hold this hand. This is the hammer. You have a holding bar. So these are essentially the five main things. And when they're all together, when they're put together just right at the same time, they function great, don't they? But if you remove any one of those, just any one of those parts right in here, the mousetrap is completely useless. It will not work. It does not matter what you... If you remove the base, there's nothing to hold all that. If you remove the spring, there's no power behind it. If you remove the hammer, even if it has power, what's it going to do? If you look at the holding bar, you have to have that to hold the trigger. Any one of those, you remove any one of those, this is dead in the water. This is what evolution is working with all the time. All these parts that had to somehow come together by chance and accident, or they are dead in the water. That really shows that it took a designer, an intelligent designer, to make that. What happens to your car engine if it gets too hot? What happens to it? Yeah, it'll break down on you. If it don't blow up, it'll break down on you, all right? And so it's not a really good thing to have your car overheat, is it, all right? But we have designed ways to keep your car cool. Even down here in New Mexico in the summer when it's really hot, in Grand Junction it's really hot, we can still go out there in 100-plus degree temperatures and everything and drive our car, because we have a system designed to keep it cool. And you all know what it is. It's that radiator system, isn't it? Where out here we have radiator filled with some type of a liquid or coolant of some kind, antifreeze or water. As the air is passing through this, it will actually help through a process called evaporation. It will actually cool things down. So we'll have, coming out of the radiator, we have a cool fluid, or in some cases air type of stuff. So this cool air or fluid is going down, and it's coming as it goes through the engine. It picks up the heat from that engine, then transfers that heat back to the radiator, where it goes through, and then that heat is actually cooled back down. Almost every car has it, isn't it? And so it is a very, very important tool for the car to have a radio so that that engine can continue right. Well, there's some other things. You know, we designed it, but you know God designed it before we came up with such stuff. He designed it in a creature like this. This is actually called the gazelle. This is a Grant's gazelle. Now, by the way, our pronghorn antelope has a system very much like this, but this is where a lot of the study has been with this gazelle right in here. It is actually designed with his own built-in radiator. And here's why he needs a radiator. A gazelle, they have a lot of critters running around Africa out there that would love to get the gazelle. So their main defense is just to pick up and run as fast as they can. By the way, they can run fast. they can run up to 50 miles an hour. I call myself an average a couch potato. I really can't even run a mile anymore. I might be able to walk a mile, but I can't run a mile anymore. And if I could, it would probably take me 11 to 12 minutes to get up. But here's this guy. He can whip out there 50 miles an hour. Now, there are some creatures like the cheetah that can run 60 miles an hour, and he can catch him. A good thing for the gazelle, the cheetah will actually can only go short distance at that speed. So if this guy's real clever. But what happens is when he runs, what's going to happen to him? Whenever we run, whenever I run or even walk fast, my body temperature builds up. Same thing with animals when they run. Their body temperature will build up. Well, the body temperature, that includes the brain right up in here. My brain is getting hot right now. I know how, Pastor, isn't it, or something? It's amazing. From that step up to here, up to the top of our brain, it is 15 to 20 degrees hotter right up in here when we're up here trying to use our brain up in here. I don't know why that is, all right? But so if I keel over, it's just because my brain just got too hot. I don't have a built-in radiator. Actually, I do. It's called sweat. But also, their body temperature increases. The brain, if the brain reaches the same temperature as the body, it will overheat, and that animal will die. You have to have blood to your brain at all times, functioning to keep you going. Huh? And that blood has to be at the same temperature. Well, God designed a radiator system in the gazelles that actually will help it keep it at a safe temperature. What we actually have right in here, the air coming through the nostrils as they're running, going to their lungs, there's actually this, there's a bunch of small arteries and everything, very much like a net system right in here. And as the air is going through that net system, the blood is going around it, it's like an evaporation system, and right away, what does it do? It begins to be cooling that blood down. That hot blood, it begin a cooling process. Just like you have swamp coolers here, don't you? And I don't know if your church is on swamp cooler, but my house is on swamp cooler. Same principle. You get air going through, and it will actually help cool the air and everything around it. Now, once that cool air goes through there, cools the blood down, it comes up, and now there's another. This is, again, some will call it a wonder net right in here. So now that blood that is being cooled down comes up. It is going back to the heart, but it's cooler compared to the blood that is going into the brain. It goes through that wonder net system. Now, the blood on the way to its brain will go through this net, and it will start losing the heat. This actually will start picking up the heat and cooling that blood down. So by the time it gets through the other side, it has cooled down. So the blood going to the brain is much cooler than the one that was actually heading to it. Just before it got to the brain. Works all like just like a radiator system right in there, just like the one on our car design. Then this cool blood is sent to the brain, and then it, of course, heads back and returns back to the heart where everything is pumped and all begins again. How well does it work? Scientists actually tested a gazelle running at 25 miles an hour for 5 minutes. Its body temperature rose from 82 degrees Fahrenheit up to 93 degrees Fahrenheit. However, the brain stayed right at or actually below 86 degrees Fahrenheit, which was very safe for the brain in here. So it's a design that works very effectively. And I think the gazelle, if he could praise the Lord, he'd say, "Thank you for that, God. Thank you for that. All right, I was able to live one more day because I could outrun. My brain didn't shut me down." Right. But understand this. That system had to be in place right from the very beginning. If it wasn't, how's that gazelle going to survive? They would have been wiped out a long time. They would not have had a defense mechanism that they could survive, and their defense mechanism is running. It had to be there right from the very beginning. Or there's no way they could be there. That points to me, to a designer, not chance and accident. It had to have somebody smart. Now, I could go on and on and on this morning about animals. I really do have a passion. I really invite you to go to our web page. I'm going to show you that in a minute. If you especially go to the kids sections, I have written about lots of animals over the years. You can go in there, and it's on PDF format and everything. It's called Kids Think and Believe. And I've written about all kinds of animals. But I want to look at this. I've already done this once with this church, but I want to do it again. I want to look at us. Now, I'm going to do just us very simply because there's so much about us. We have so much design in the human body. But let's just take a look at our eye. The eye is a wonderful, wonderful tool. It works like a camera, but there's not a camera in the world that can even come close to the human eye if your eye is working properly. Now, by the way, where did the camera come from? We actually took the technology from an eye to develop cameras. So the technology is actually the camera and the eye work very, very much the same way. But again, there's not a camera in the world that can keep up. See, I can look at everybody in the back here. I wave at you way back there. I can look at you up front here. And I can look at my hand very close there. And if it was dark out, I could stand outside and look up in the clear sky. I could look on those far, 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 far distant stars. And when I do that, every time I look someplace different, I don't have to stop and take time to twist my ears and tweak my nose to bring you into focus. Just automatically, bang, you're in focus just like that. There's not a camera in the world can do that. Even our automatic focus cameras today, I've got one that a really nice camera. It used to work very nice until I dropped it too many times. But you know, it has the little shutter, the little trigger where you hold it halfway down. What you don't see is sending out a little light signal that goes out and bounces whatever I'm aiming it at. It bounces and reflects it back to the camera, and the camera with a little computer measures how long it took that light to go out and get back to the camera, so it can figure the distance in that way. And then a little computer then tells the shutter, a little motor upon the shutter and everything, how to move to bring you into focal length. So you push it down, and you can actually literally most of the time see your shutter until it locks in. And by the way, it doesn't always lock in the right distance. You still have to manually override it sometime. It takes time. Now, some of them are very quick, but it still takes time. But my eye, I look at you guys, and just like that, it's automatic. There's not a camera in the world. Even as proud as we are of our cameras in the world, they cannot come even close to the human eye, the eye that is working properly out there. And the eye is just a tool with a lot of other senses of the brain, sending information to the brain. Even secular scientists today will agree that the human brain is the most complex thing in all the universe. There's nothing more complex than the human brain. We know it works very much like a computer today, electrical signals being bounced around, things like that, but there's not a computer in the world that can even come close to what your brain can do. They're telling us today, it's calculated the human brain can store up to 1 trillion bits of information. And the most powerful supercomputer today, which is down in Japan, can only store 0.1% of that, of what's your human brain, what's your brain. Guys, I got 1 trillion bits of information swimming around up here. Now, here's my problem. I can't find all those bits, all right? There are some of them are tucked away very deeply, all right? But they're all up there. They're actually working. And what about the speed? The speed is phenomenal. We're capable of 10 quadrillion calculations per second. That's 10 million billion calculations per second. Now, you know, I say, I can't figure out problems like that. Well, understand, right, every bit of your body is being controlled by your brain. There's things going on all the time you're not even thinking about, but your brain is, and it's taking care of them, right? Little hiccups every time you move, every time you, everything you're doing is being controlled by that brain. It's constantly working at a very high speed. That is 100 times faster than the world's fastest computer, 100 trillion calculations per second. They have a big one over in Japan now. It's like 850 big, huge supercomputers hooked together. It's equivalent to about 250,000 laptops like this, pretty high-end laptops all stuck together. And they'll give it a problem, and it will take them sometimes up to 14 minutes working as fast as they can to solve a problem that you can do in less than a second. And by the way, that it'll fill up a room, the computers will fill up a room this size. They have 3 other rooms that are this size hooked up to a radiator system just to keep these things cooled down so they don't burn up when they're working that fast, right? Our brain is just absolutely amazing. There's nothing in the world even comes close to it. Yet evolution is teaching us that that all happened by chance and by accident. Does that look like chance and accident to you? Even the things that we can design, we can't even come close to the things we see around us. That was done, I believe, points to design. So who is that designer? Well, the Bible tells us that too. This is my favorite verse, Psalms 139, verse 14. I will praise thee. And who is thee? That's God. I will praise thee, I will praise God, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and by the way, we are works of God. Marvelous are thy works, that my soul knoweth right well. How many of you in here today believe this verse right up in here? When you look out there, do you believe you were created by God? I believe so. And the Bible declares it, nature declares it out there. If we just open up our eyes, our ears, and mostly our heart, to understand that. Again, I invite you to go to our webpage right in here, Discover Creation, and I would like to share something. We just came out of a team meeting just on Thursday. I haven't got ready to get a slide up, but we are actually have a Facebook thing now, and we invite you to go to our Facebook, and if you are on Facebook, and just hit like or share. It's Alpha Omega Institute. All you have to do is put that in there on Facebook, and it will come up. If you'd like it, share it. Here's why we'd like to do that. We've actually, because we are a small ministry, our teachings are we don't show up on search very much out there. ICR, Answers in Genesis do, the bigger ones, because they have lots of internet presence out there, and we do a lot of things, but our presence is up there. We want to start using Facebook as a tool to get information out. What it is, Facebook is just the link. It is the dispersion system, and it will take you to YouTube to show you little short clips and videos, things like this. And this is a way, instead of, I just shared that sometimes during the year I'll get out to 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000 on an average kids and adults a year. But on Facebook, if we get enough people behind our Facebook, like an accountant, your friends liking it and keeping it going, our presence will be out there. And there's the capability that within a day we can do not just thousands, but we can actually do millions of getting the message out. You know, this is where our kids are today. This is where technology is going. And they've actually shown that companies like Kodak, for example, right, that they're the ones that invented the digital camera, but they decided to stay with their film and everything. They didn't keep up with the media type of stuff out there. And they are struggling greatly today. Today, we have to change a little bit. Now, it's hard for me because I'm 67, almost 68 years old, and this is a new concept for me. But it's one I'm willing to learn because I can see it as another tool that we can use out there to get God's Word. Not just here in the United States, but Facebook is worldwide today. We can get it in every country out there. But it's going to take work. I'm actually developing, when I get back, I'm going to actually make one for kids. It's going to be directed towards kids that they understand. Because I've looked at some of the sites out there, they got videos for kids, and they're just all us adults up there. The top scientists out there talking in terms that kids haven't got a clue. So I'm going to try to do this one where it's simplified. So watch for that too. So we invite you to go to our website and check us on Facebook. If you don't go on Facebook yet, get your account just so you can say like, all right?